gone, what shall I do?
Away, the high-low.
My Tommy's gone, and I'll go too.
Tommy's gone to the high-low.
Sailing down to Callao.
Away, to the high-low.
Them Spanish girls he'll meet, I know.
Tommy's gone to the high-low.
Oh, I love my Tom, and he loves me.
Away to the high-low.
He thinks of me when he's at sea.
Tommy's gone to the high-low.
Good afternoon, Monterey Bay and online listeners. It's every other Sunday again, and it's day 34 of the Great Hunkering Down. Welcome to Sustainability Now, a biweekly program focused on environment and social justice in the Monterey Bay region, California, and the world. I'm your host, Ronnie Lipschitz, and today we are doing something rather strange. We're broadcasting basically from three different places. I'm at home, my guest is at her home, and Emily Donham is running things in the K-Squid studio. So if there are any technical glitches, you'll know why. My guest today is Rachel Kippen, Executive Director of O'Neill Sea Odyssey and a columnist for the Santa Cruz Sentinel. Are you there, Rachel?
I am. Hi, Ronnie.
Okay, let me finish doing this, all right?
All right.
Rachel has worked in environmental education since 2010, and according to a Sierra Club blurb that I found, she was previously Director of Programs at Save Our Shores. She's worked as a marine science educator, a kayak guide, and a whale tour naturalist. She holds 2 degrees in environmental studies, grew up on 2 islands, one in the Puget Sounds and the other in Hawaii. So she spent her youth learning about the ocean by snorkeling, surfing, and paddling. O'Neill Sea Odyssey is a Monterey-based introduction to marine sciences for students in grades 4 to 6 aboard the 65-foot O'Neill catamaran. So welcome, Rachel. Let's get started. So why don't you start by telling us about O'Neill Sea Odyssey, how it got started, what its missions and goals are, how it's funded, things like that. Hello?
Hello? It dropped out, but I'm back on. I just missed the end. I think I missed the end of you talking about Sea Odyssey.
Okay, so we'll try that again. So tell us about O'Neill Sea Odyssey and how it got started and what its missions and goals are.
All right. Thank you so much for having me today. And also thank you for dealing with all of the technical challenges of doing this completely remote. Sea Odyssey started in 1996. It was founded, as you can imagine, it's all in the name, by Jack O'Neill. And Jack had a catamaran, the one that we're currently using today, the beautiful 65-foot catamaran that he used for his own ocean recreation and adventures. He actually used to have hot air balloons that would land on it. He would fly a hot air balloon and land on the boat.
Yeah, so I actually personally unfortunately get to know Jack well. I've met him in passing at an event once, but everybody who knows him and knew him and who was close to him and his family, all to this day speak about how passionate he was about all that the ocean brought to him. You know, not only did it bring him his livelihood and a business, but a place for him to experience exciting adventures, a place of solace, a place to grieve. And he really wanted to pass that along to students, in particular the young people that wouldn't have that kind of opportunity or connection to the ocean. And so, you know, he was using his catamaran like for his own adventures, and then came up with the idea of running pool programs on it, and worked with his family, worked with his son and daughter, worked with some local educators and our public school system, and then really brought a group together to start O'Neill Sea Odyssey. And so we've been using that same catamaran since 1996 when we started. There were, you know, a handful of groups those first couple years, and now we're serving anywhere between 210 and 215 classes a year, about 5,500 fourth through sixth grade students.
Well, and do you go out every day during the school year?
Yeah, pretty much. Twice a day, typically Tuesdays through Fridays. We save Mondays for any kind of weather issue or reschedule that we need. But yeah, the program's about 3 hours, and so we'll do two programs a day, 4 to 5 days a week. Yeah.
So I had one quick question, which is, what is the relationship between your program and the company?
Yeah, great question. So we're partners, but we're separated because we are a 501c3 nonprofit, and we do fundraise. All of our funds from our generous community of supporters makes our program entirely free, and so we can't have a single kind of single funding source with O'Neill, for example. So we are very lucky, though, that the boat is owned by O'Neill Yacht Charters, and we use it. And that relationship, I think, is so cool because it means that, you know, we get to use this world-class sailing vessel. I mean, every time I go on that boat, I'm losing my mind about it. But that would be really challenging for a nonprofit to be able to sustain and upkeep. And even just to haul it out, it costs like $300,000. So we're partners, and we have a couple of the family members on our board, which is really nice because we get to still kind of keep that connection, of course, to the original intention.
So, you know, I was looking at the website the other day, and what are you guys doing right now?
Yeah, so a little rough. It's been a little rough. Of course, you know, all these nonprofits are experiencing this. We're an experiential program that's hands-on, right? So we're not running programs. We are doing some distance learning. We've reached out to all of our teachers, and we've been in kind of weekly contact with them. I'm still providing them with videos of plankton and scientific illustration challenges and all sorts of things. But yeah, we aren't able to run our program right now. And we hope that as soon as it's safe, of course, that we'll just be able to jump right back in and get started again. Because as I'm sure you know, we're all feeling pretty cooped up. So when the moment comes that we can get back out on the water, that will be glorious.
Yeah, well, I guess we're all hoping it comes pretty soon, but we'll see. So how did you get into this business?
What's that?
How did you get into this business? You know, what's your background in environmental education?
Thanks for asking. Yeah, so I think it really for me, it's similar to actually the entire point of this program. I was very fortunate to have a lot of experiential, hands-on science and nature activities as a child. My parents were incredibly supportive of that. I had a couple different formative moments where, you know, I got to be on the water on boats myself, and growing up on two different islands, just really was surrounded by water. And by the time, you know, I actually was a really not wonderful high school student, but I got really lucky and got into a school that gave me some funding for my being part Native Hawaiian. And in any event, environmental studies ended up being such a wonderful degree for a learner like me, in that it kind of brought all of these different things together. It brought nature immersion together, education together, thinking about policy and advocacy, you know, local government. And I was so interested in that. That then, you know, got my degree in that, and then just really tested a lot of different career pathways out. Spent a little bit of time in research, realized that I liked talking more about what I was doing than, you know, actually chasing around salt marsh turtles, for example. And then did a lot of education at a lot of different marine science institutions, and ultimately wound up here. Very, very lucky to wind up here.
Well, I was going to ask how you ended up in Santa Cruz, since you're from Hawaii.
Yeah, so I actually, my parents took me on a road trip, my brothers and I, down the entire West Coast when I was 10, and we stopped in Santa Cruz for a night, and we stayed at the Dream Inn, and we went to the boardwalk. I mean, we just did all the things that tourists do, but for me, I remember so vividly being like, wait, there's a place that has a roller coaster right on the beach, and there's sea otters also. I'd never seen a sea otter before, and there were sea otters right in front of us. And I made a mental note as a 10-year-old, like, I'm going to come back here. This is a spot that I need to come back. It's actually kind of creepy. My mom sent it to me. I even made a drawing of myself, and I put all of these little bubbles around it, and I was like, Rachel will live in Santa Cruz and save animals. to all these other solutions. But that was fortuitous.
So, you know, let's get back to the Odyssey and the catamaran. So what's a typical outing like? Since this is restricted to 4 to 6 graders, most of us won't get the chance to do the trip. So I was just wondering, you know, what happens on a typical outing?
On a trip. So the students will show up, and the kind of first thing that we're doing is making sure that they're all feeling safe and comfortable, right? So again, for the majority of our students, they've never been on the ocean before. A lot of them have never been to the coast before. I'm sure you know this, but even in Santa Cruz County, students that are living, you know, 3-4 miles from the beach just don't have access. Students in the Pajaro Valley, we serve a lot of students actually from the Salinas Valley as well. So again, not very far from the coast, but just have never been. And so we're wanting to spend a lot of time making sure that they feel comfortable and that their chaperones and parents and teachers all feel comfortable. We'll do a safety briefing at our office. We get them into their life vest. They walk down onto our dock and go to our boat, and they get another kind of acquaintance with the boat where they make sure that they know where everything is and they know what is safe behavior and not safe behavior on the boat. And then we take them out and we do kind of a nice little loop where we go out of the harbor mouth, we hug the coast, we kind of check out the sea otters and the kelp forest. We go around the wharf because, as you know, the wharf always has action. There's always sea lions underneath the wharf on the pilings jumping around for them to see. We'll head past Towels over to West Cliff, and we'll kind of hang out near the lighthouse area often. And then we'll head out to sea just a couple miles, and then we'll loop back. And on that entire tour, they're doing 3 stations. They're rotating between a biology station, an ecology station, and a navigation station. So we break the group down into 3 subgroups of 10 students per group. Again, trying to make them feel comfortable, and each group has an instructor. So it's a 1-to-10 ratio. And they're doing things like learning about kelp forest ecology, why sea otters are keystone species. They're learning about plankton. They'll do a little plankton tow. They'll pick a net and drag it in the water behind the boat to collect plankton. And then they'll actually take a handheld compass and they'll collect 3 compass bearing points while they're on the water. And we'll take that back to our education center in the Santa Cruz Harbor to use for our follow-up labs. They'll also get to just hang out. I mean, we have a big, beautiful net that's in between the 2 holes on our catamaran, and they just, you know, face plant on it and look at the water underneath them.
Dude, how do they prepare? Do they do preparation before they go on a trip?
They do, yeah. So our program, I think, is really unique in a variety of ways. One, it's totally free. The one thing that we ask that the class does in kind of return and making sure that the messages are really landing with them is that they complete a community service project, and that can happen at any point during the school year when they come out with us, but they can do something like a beach cleanup or a native planting, and we'll partner with them with some other nonprofits to make that happen. And then we also have bilingual ocean science curriculum that is Next Generation Science Standard and Common Core aligned. And we give that to the teacher. And the goal being that there is an actual unit that the students would be learning about in their classroom. And as you know, public school teachers are really, really busy and have to teach a lot of things. So, sometimes we'll see teachers that kind of go all out and they'll make it not just an ocean unit, it'll be like an ocean year. And then sometimes we'll do, you know, a little bit more hand-holding with the curriculum. But the goal is that they'll have that curriculum in their classroom, that they'll do a community service project related to the health of their watershed, that they'll come out on the program itself and really be immersed in it. And then we'll also do follow-up. So they do have access to the data that they collect every single trip we collect data. And they're able to then take that off of our website and do kind of follow-up reports of, you know, we saw this many sea otters, and in 2008, they saw 20 sea otters on the same day, and in 2020, we saw, I don't know, 15. You know, so we can start kind of seeing what it would be like to really be a scientist.
Do they look at data from past trips? They compare, do comparisons, or just their own trips?
Yeah, they have access to it if they'd like. I mean, it all depends kind of on what their question is. They can look at previous data. They can look at their own data and make conclusions. But yeah, the goal being that they were the ones that collected the data themselves and they understand it, and hopefully, you know, come up with some questions that they want to start thinking about and utilizing that data, or what other data do they need that they hadn't thought about as a result of their learning with us.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, one of the things that, of course, we're always curious about is what are the long-term impacts on students from their, you know, as a result of their experiences. And I was wondering whether the OSO has ever tried to track students to see where they end up. Whether they've ended up in marine conservation or oceanography or some other related field. Do you try doing that?
Yeah, that's a great question. So we had one study done by actually one of our instructors. He's still an instructor with us, and she's fabulous, named Lauren Hanneman. For her master's degree, she did a study on students that had gone through our program that were then high schoolers, that were high schoolers, and tried to come up with a kind of rubric of how to evaluate what they retained in terms of messaging. And she found and published her study that about 75% of her of the population that she studied had retained messages related to ocean protection, conservation, and not so surprisingly, but it's always nice to have the data that supports it, that the students were much more likely to have retained that kind of messaging if not only they had an experience with us, but if they had an experience with another partner environmental nonprofit. So if they'd come out with us, you know, between fourth and sixth grade, and then maybe done a program with Watsonville Wetlands Watch, maybe in high school they became part of the aquarium's high school intern program, then that they were much more likely to retain all of those messages if they'd really been stewarded through their entire career, or I guess learning career as students. And outside of that, you know, there's of course a lot of privacy around being able to track students, which we kind of dug into that we need to make sure we're being really cognizant of. But we have had, you know, kind of done like general blasts out and be like, hey, you know, share stories with us, especially around our last anniversary. And so folks kind of came back and told us what they were doing. We have a lot of people who have become public school teachers and then bring their students out, which is also really amazing to see. And what I personally find to be really inspiring is that, yes, of course, you know, it's great to have students become scientists and, you know, marine biologists, but we also have a lot of students that become, you know, all sorts of different careers, and they still integrate their learning from Sea Odyssey into what they're doing. A quick example being a gentleman that I met with Sombrilo Packaging. Are you familiar with Sombrilo Packaging?
No.
So they're a company based out of Watsonville. They've been around for about 100 years, and they do agricultural packaging for, you know, shipping around produce. Plastic berry clamshell, for example, and those green mesh strawberry baskets made out of plastic. One of their staff was a student at O'Neill Sea Odyssey, and then he went into his career at Sombrilo, worked with another woman to really create some sustainable alternatives to the plastic packaging that they were using for their products, and launched a whole recyclable, compostable cardboard line called ReadyCycle that happened a couple years ago. And then he came back to us and he said, you know, I remember learning about how all of our actions on land impact the ocean and the products that we use and how important it is, and it just still sticks in my head, and that's why I wanted to have this be such a part of my career. And that's so cool. You know, think about all the different ways that ocean conservation can spread out, not just in, you know, the formal careers that we think of.
Yeah, you know, I can't help but reflect on my experience in elementary school when there was no such thing. I mean, it's because that was 60 years ago. So, I don't think anybody ever thought about doing things like this. We went to dusty, musty museums at best. It's pretty remarkable on the whole, you know, the way in which environmental education has been integrated into K-12.
I completely agree. Yeah.
So, what do you do in all of this? Okay, what sorts of activities do you engage in? Because I'm sure you write grants all the time, but
yes.
What else?
Yeah, that's like, I would say that's so much of it. I really do I do all of our fundraising and the all of our communications, public relations. So typically a week will look, I mean, obviously we're in a really weird spot right now, but a week will look like, you know, meeting with some of our donors, writing several grants, and doing some administrative stuff, making sure that there's just a lot of things about nonprofit management that you can predict that will come up and then, of course, that you are surprised by. Anything from like a Coast Guard, inspection and making sure that all of our policies are up to par to pass various standards, helping with our hiring of seasonal instructors, all of that administrative fundraising and communication. And I do get to do, I get to do community presentations. What's really fun about my role in particular is that I get to go out and meet a lot of people, meet a lot of people that want to support us, that have ideas for collaboration, partners that want to go in on grants together. I spend a lot of time doing that and talking about why the Odyssey is so important and why people how people can get involved. And that's a big part of what I do. And that, of course, then in turn helps it, provide ideas, endless ideas for things to write about, getting to talk to so many different community members.
Yeah, well, let's turn into your writing. So you've been doing this column for the Sentinel. What's it called?
It's called Our Ocean Backyard.
Did you replace Gary Griggs, or are you alternating with him?
I'm alternating with him. I took Dan Hayfrey's spot.
Oh, okay. Well, so you started doing this about a year ago, right?
Yeah.
And how did it happen that you started doing this?
Yeah, that's a great question. Well, so I guess to back up, the column started, our Ocean Backyard started as an idea that Dan, I want to say it was 11 or 12 years ago, I'm not totally sure, you can correct me, noticed that there wasn't a lot of ocean and environmental issues in our newspaper, and especially living in a coastal community and being like, wow, people are living here for this reason, and there's so much that we can educate folks about and share about what's going on. We're just such a hub and a hot spot on the West Coast. And so he brought that forward to the Sentinel, thinking that, maybe I'll write like one column or one article. And they're like, sure, okay, send us something. And he did. And then they're like, okay, well, keep sending us more. So it just kind of grew into this column. And then he started alternating every other week with Gary Griggs. And I read it since I've lived in Santa Cruz. I've been here for 8 years. I've read it pretty consistently that entire time. And just got a sense of the kinds of stuff that they were covering and what I really like about it is that it can get really geeky, but it can also be a beacon for hope and inspiration for people.
You're listening to KSQD 90.7 FM in Santa Cruz and ksquid.org on the internet. If you're there, Emily, take it away.
Hello, I'm Jason Hyduk, your fire chief for the city of Santa Cruz. I'm here with news that is going to help protect our community from the spread of coronavirus, known as COVID-19. An order to shelter in place has been issued by our Santa Cruz County Health Officer. This order is effective now. It requires everyone to stay at home and leave only for essential needs and services. If we all comply with this order, we can restrict the spread of COVID-19. I know from decades as an emergency responder how important it is to take breaks from this stress. Whether it's music, yoga, running, find something for counterbalance during these difficult days and prioritize self-care. Please take time to include these activities for you and your loved ones. It is important. We will get through this together. Thank you for doing your part in obeying the shelter-in-place order. For more information with specific guidelines, go to cityofsantacruz.com/coronavirus.
Got an old car taking up space in your garage or driveway? Why not put a squid behind the wheel? Donate your used car to KSQD through the Car Easy Donation Program. They even make the arrangements to have it towed. You get a tax deduction, and KSQD gets a monetary contribution. For more information, go to the donate page of our website, ksqd.org. Thanks.
Social distancing slows the spread of coronavirus, so stay a minimum of 6 feet away from others and stay home if you can. More info at coronavirus.gov. Let's all do our part, because we're all hashtag alone together. Brought to you by the Ad Council.
Hi, everyone. I'm Linda Berman-Hall, founding host of A Cutting Edge. Every Sunday at 7:30 on KSQD 90.7 FM, one of our co-hosts interviews UCSC researchers about the lectures, book signings, conferences, or performances that they'll soon be sharing with the community. Learn the inside story here on KSQD 90.7 FM.
All right, Ronnie, we have Rachel back online. So back to you.
You're listening to Sustainability Now. I'm Ronnie Lipschitz. My guest today is Rachel Kippen, Executive Director of O'Neill Sea Odyssey and a columnist for the Santa Cruz Sentinel. Before we get started, I just wanted to let everybody know that K-Squid is going to be starting its spring pledge drive on Tuesday, running for a week. So stay tuned to the station so you can, you know, give and give generously. Okay, Rachel, so we were talking about your column and how you got, how you started writing it.
Dan and Gary were trading off for over a decade, and then as Dan was getting ready to retire, he mentioned it to me. You know, it's not part of the job. It's separate of my job at O'Neill Sea Odyssey. Mostly yeah. In that it would be boring if I wrote about O'Neill Sea Odyssey every single, you know, two times a month. I think people would probably get sick of that. And Dan was really gracious and asked if I would be interested in taking it over. And what I think is particularly exciting about that is that it's just a new voice, you know, a different take on things, a person that, you know, might have different community members that I speak to that I can highlight. I think I started in April, maybe, or the end of March last year. So it's just been about a year now. And it's been so fun. It's been so incredibly fun and really a privilege to be able to have a platform like that to talk about things that are important to me and hopefully important to a lot of other people.
I looked over a bunch of the columns for this, and you know, I was curious, how do you decide what to write about?
Yeah, well, when I first started, I got, you know, I was nervous. So I sketched out a bunch of different subject areas that I thought, you know, would be cool to think about and write about. And as the year progressed, I got more comfortable and kind of let things come to me. And really, there's just so much going on here all the time that is incredible. Related to the ocean and in the environment. I mean, we have, as I'm sure you're aware, we have so many nonprofits here that are doing work related to the environment and the ocean. And we have so many folks that even, again, might not be looked at as ocean-related from just like a super strict standpoint, but have connection to the ocean. And as I meet those people and hear their stories, think about, you know, sharing them back out. So a lot of it's actually just kind of come up through casual conversation, through meeting new people, through thinking about specifically how to represent folks who haven't been represented. That's been a piece of it that I've really enjoyed too. Being like, wow, you know, we haven't told a lot of stories about women of color and their experience working on climate change as it relates to the ocean, or there haven't been enough stories about how the ocean's healing power can have a really positive effect on mental health or cystic fibrosis or, you know, all of these things, again, that I wouldn't have necessarily known had I not gotten to meet these people or thought of and just really feeling like, okay, cool, if I get this platform, how can that be a way to truly amplify some of that stuff? And I mean, for example, recently I was able to write about Operation Surf. You know, I've heard of Operation Surf. They're a local nonprofit, but I didn't know that much about their program. But, you know, I met a woman who does their fundraising for them, and I met one of the vets who went through their program. And I was just completely humbled and just overwhelmed by their nonprofit, and then got to write about that, of how veterans experience just a whole new connection to the ocean and to one another through surfing.
Okay. I was going to ask you to explain what it was.
To elaborate. Yeah.
So I haven't heard about it.
Yeah, rehabilitative programming and connected programming with veterans through surfing. And do that right here in Santa Cruz.
Yeah, well, you know, one of the columns I found particularly intriguing and interesting, and I want to try, is the walking Monterey Bay.
Yeah! Woohoo!
Beach walk. Talk to us about that one.
Yeah, okay, cool. When I first moved here, I thought I knew the bay pretty well. And I started dating this guy who was like, you love walking, and I heard you could walk the entire coastline from Santa Cruz to Monterey in a few days, and, you know, you want to try it? And I was like, okay, sure. And we did that together, and then now I've walked it I've probably walked it at least 15 times, and it's amazing. I mean, you can walk down to our local beach, and typically, if you want to be on the sand for as long as possible, if you start at New Brighton State Beach, you can be walking on the sand almost uninterrupted all the way to Del Monte Beach in Monterey, just a nice, flat, sandy shoreline. The only places where things can get a little hairy, depending on the time of year, you might have to wade through the Pajaro River. And then, of course, at Elkhorn Slough, unless you have a buddy who wants to pick you up and tow you across the harbor mouth, on their boat, you've got to walk around on Highway 1 on the bridge there before you can get back onto the sand. But other than that, you are just walking on the sand for days at a time. And my experience doing these bay walks, I've done it pretty much at every time of year you possibly can. I've gone in the summer. I've gone when it's busy with tourists. I've gone in rainstorms. I've gone in the dead of winter where the surf is huge. That you really get to see the seasons of the bay, and we do have seasons. We really do. You know, people think that we might not be a seasonal place, but you can see how the seasons impact the coast. You can see how people impact the coast. You can see all of the different kinds of species and the ways that they make their living, depending on the time of year. And then when you are done walking the bay, I mean, your sense of direction, at least I think, your sense of direction, your kind of familiarity and understanding of place is just so radically different. I don't personally think that I would be as effective at my work if I hadn't walked the bay. And it's beautiful and pretty much free. I mean, it's super easy in a lot of ways. You can just put stuff on your back, and if you get into a spot where you're like, you know what, I'm just going to walk off the beach here and, you know, grab some food if I, you know, don't like what I brought for lunch, or if you get into any kind of position where you need some help, you've got cell phone service the entire way. Not that that's always a good thing, but it's just, I feel like a lot of different levels of people who are like hardcore backpackers or people who are just wanting to have more of a casual experience, there's something for everyone in that.
Yeah, it's something. I mean, I find it quite intriguing.
Sure.
You know, and might actually try it. Do you have any favorite subjects amongst the things that you've covered?
Yeah. Do I have any favorite subjects? Well, I really liked writing about actually walking the bay. I would say anything, again, where I kind of get to bring something forward that's not typically been talked about, especially related to ocean and environmental, like kind of what ocean scientists and environmentalists look like, or how, you know, what our society's way of environmentalism typically being for maybe someone who is fluffier or white or, not representative of how diverse and dynamic our entire sustainability and environmental community is. I think to write about that is really, I think, important and interesting. And then over the year, too, it's been for me kind of a little bit of a journey of writing for what I think is, like, you know, politically correct to actually feeling like I have more of a voice over the last few months. So just feeling a little bit more comfortable and creative. I think it's kind of intimidating to think that all these strangers are going to read your words and they don't know you. So lately I feel like I've gotten a little bit more personal, and people have gotten more feedback on that's been really positive, of people really liking personal stories and kind of more narrative style writing that's not robotic or always feeling super correct. And that's very encouraging because I, of course, would prefer to write like that. But it's just kind of my level of comfort and how that's changed over time.
Have you done any other writing besides this?
Yeah, well, actually, in pretty much every role I've had, so prior to this, I worked for the city of Watsonville for a couple of years as their environmental project coordinator, but that was a lot of communications, a lot of environmental communications, sustainability communications. When I worked at Save Our Shores, I did a lot of the communications there, blogs, all of our PR. I did some academic writing. It's not, obviously not the same. I'm currently working on a publication. But that kind of writing, at least the rigor and the all of the different styles, which, of course, you are very, very familiar with, prepared me, I think, in a way to be able to write distinctly if I need to.
And
accurately, you know, and go through all of those processes, which you go through when you do research on anything. But is this information correct? Who said what? How did they say it? How did they cite them? So I've had a mix of, you know, writing a lot for nonprofits, writing my own blogs, and then writing in an academic setting. But have I ever had anything?
Does your blog appear? Is it? I think I saw it, but is it on the OSO website or is it somewhere else?
I had a personal blog. I don't have that available
to the public
anymore. No. Actually, someone encouraged me to take. I don't know if this is possible, but encouraged me to take the columns and put them into a blog, so that they would be available to people, you know, after the Sentinel ran them, which I thought that was a pretty cool idea.
Well, I just looked you up on the Sentinel, and I mean all the articles appeared, so it's mostly I was just getting permission to reproduce them. That's pretty straightforward. Well, it doesn't that doesn't matter. That's, you know, don't have to talk about it on the radio show. Why don't we take another break? And then I'd actually like to come back, and because you mentioned in one of your columns E.F. Schumacher and Small is Beautiful.
Yeah.
And I thought it'd be interesting to spend a little time talking about that. Okay.
Sounds great.
So
okay.
We'll take a break and then we'll finish up with that. All right. So you're listening to KSQD 90.7 FM in Santa Cruz and KSQD.org on the internet. And over to you, Emily.
Thanks, Ronnie. So join KSQD this Sunday at 6 p.m. for our monthly program, Reflections on Buddhism. This month, Patrick McGinn hosts a conversation with the Venerable Tenzin, a local Buddhist nun and teacher, with spiritual perspectives on coping with the COVID pandemic. That's Sunday evening from 6 to 7 on KSQD, 90.7 FM. Many voices, one station. Back to you, Ronnie.
Okay. You're listening to Sustainability Now on KSQD, 90.7 FM. My guest today is Rachel Kippen, Executive Director of O'Neill Sea Odyssey, and we are doing a three-way communication, which is why we've been having a couple of interesting technical glitches, but things are going pretty well. And what I suggested to Rachel was that we spend a little time talking about E.F. Schumacher and Small is Beautiful, which, of course, doesn't have anything directly to do with the ocean, but she mentioned it in one of her recent columns, and I suggested we talk about it. So, Rachel, why don't you tell us, you know, about Schumacher and his book?
Yeah, well, you know, it was interesting. I mean, in that column, I was writing about how I was, like, digging through all of these things while I'm here sheltering in place in my very tiny, cluttered house. And I literally did unearth that book, that Schumacher's book. And that's kind of a beautiful thing about writing columns, too, right, is that, like, your brain might have been, you know, thinking about some subject area, and then you run into something in life serendipitously in front of your face, and it puts these two together. So that week prior to that was when we first closed for Sea Odyssey, and when we also experienced this incredible plankton bloom. And so I've been thinking a lot about that, and just how beautiful and how prolific plankton specifically are. I mean, like, wow, this tiny little thing provides oxygen, and it provides the basis for our entire marine ecosystem in the bay, and it's the reason that we are so we are such a draw for all of these migratory species. I'm thinking, and so it made me think a lot about scale, I guess, is what I'm getting to. Just being like, tiny little thing, huge impact, really matters. And it really matters that we protect this tiny, tiny, tiny little thing. And then I saw his book, and then I remembered, oh, yeah, I went down that rabbit hole several years ago. And so that's kind of where those two trains of thought kind of married each other, and that then made the column. But it really, I mean, I think a lot of people are thinking, or I'm making an assumption here, about, of course, our economy right now. And, you know, how did we get into this situation that feels really terrifying in a lot of ways, and how do we get out of it? And I think a lot of people also are recognizing, especially in the sustainability community, that there's lessons to be learned here about, you know, scaling it back down and focusing on our human relationships, our relationships with quote-unquote resources and natural resources, and especially, you know, as you know, Schumacher defining what is actually renewable. And if I'm remembering what I read, a lot about, you know, oil and how we think about just the value of something and can it be renewed over time, and even just education as a resource, as a valuable resource, and how do we evaluate things. My brain kind of spun off on that. That was a whole campaign, but yeah.
Yeah, Schumacher wrote what he called Buddhist economics, as I recall. I mean, it's been a long time since I read the book. And the notion was essentially that it is good not to be just driven by consumption, right, by more and bigger.
Right.
And more, right? And so the whole theme of
right.
Small is beautiful was basically, you know, thinking about limits. Of
yep.
course, when
yep.
he wrote it, I guess it was in the 70s, right? That
yeah.
was after just after Limits to Growth appeared, and so there was and it was of course during the oil crises, which were really not about
yeah.
oil shortages, but so it was really in the air, and it became one of the classics. That one reads,
yeah.
you know, if one is doing environmental studies or something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, go on.
Yeah, I guess that we mentioned Buddhist economics, like just thinking about, I went in a little bit of a research hole there too about how, what do we decide to consume? You know, not only what are our limits of consumption, but like, ethically and morally as human beings, like, should we be using this resource or should we be creating this thing? That needs to be part of, you know, how we exist and what we buy and sell. And I think that's really important and something that, again, connects back to this time when we emerge from this sheltering in place and this crisis. How can we take some of those lessons? Because I do think there are probably a lot of people who are being forced to see the small things now, you know, and being forced to see the things that they might have taken for granted especially related to the planet. And not to go off too much of a tangent, but another thing that was coming up for me when I was writing that was that, that we look at a lot of things that the Earth gives us. In this current system, we take it and we sell it, and they're free gifts from the Earth, essentially, that we need to survive, right? And I guess the big one that comes to my mind is water. and taking this free gift from the earth that is water and then turning it into a commodity and bottling and selling it, and how backwards of an idea that is, being like everybody needs access to water. And that is not that was a free gift meant for everybody, you know, not meant for a corporation to make a huge profit off of. And how can we evaluate those things that we've done over and over again, not only with the earth, but also with other people, right? Where we're not paying people appropriately for the services that they're providing, childcare, healthcare, educators, it kind of all flows together.
Yeah, I've had a couple of thoughts about all of this. The first one is the extent to which so many people rely on employment, in various kinds of services which are funded by people, going out to eat and things like that, right? And it becomes really basically recycling money. And how stable or fragile is that?
Right.
And then you mentioned the whole issue of commodifying water.
Right.
And of course, we live in a society in which plentiful water is taken for granted, right? You turn on the faucet and the stuff comes out.
Yep.
And there's still places where people have to carry water every day.
Yep.
They buy it from water sellers at exorbitant prices. Economists would say, that's good. Expensive water is good because then you use it more carefully. But that's sort of obvious that that's the solution. How does that kind of thinking affect, O'Neill? See Odyssey in any way? I mean, has it sort of driven you to think about what it is you're engaged in? I'm just curious. I mean, I picked up at the university, and it certainly forced me to think about it.
I think that's a good question. I think what it does for me often is it makes me think about, our entire nonprofit model, not just Sea Odyssey, but all of our nonprofits locally. And that's another thing that's kind of been in the mix, of course, with this virus, is already nonprofits are in this weird position, I personally believe, right? I think we're very valuable and needed, but we're not for profit. And so we're constantly needing to be funded by various sources. And then when you get into a pandemic and now we don't have programs that we're running, and a lot of our nonprofits are really struggling, and they're going to really struggle on the other end of this, especially the environmental, I believe, and the arts, because we're not seen at this current juncture as essential, which I also understand. I understand that there are people who are, they're food banks, and there are people who are addressing homelessness and really trying to save lives. But when we have systems like these where it just doesn't feel like all of our services are being evaluated accurately or made sure to be maintained in perpetuity, how can I rethink our structure of funding and what does it look like to be sustainable as a nonprofit? And then I think on an education scale, I mean, just we of course, 4th through 6th graders, we're covering a variety of subject areas, and we don't want to overwhelm them. But we do talk about consumer responsibility. I mean, that is part of what we share with them in the conservation messages that we teach them, and getting them to think about how they could influence their school to make better purchasing practices, or if they have the resource and capability to be able to do that with their families. Kind of whatever makes sense for them, or even just for them to start thinking about it. I do think it connects to both what we teach and then also our larger structure.
Yeah, I mean, the whole sort of nonprofit world, I started one about, 30 years ago in Berkeley, and it was much, in many ways, the environment was much less competitive, and the nonprofit world has become a place for people to go to work, especially, younger folks. And they sort of absorb, in a way, surplus labor. And it's we talk about this a lot in the university, right? Is that, people who get PhDs, maybe they can find jobs other than academic jobs, right? Which is to say, you know, maybe in industry, but maybe in the nonprofit sector, right? There is this possibility. And again, it's one of these accounting tricks that we've come up with. I mean, again, it's not a reflection on what the kinds of things that nonprofits do. But a reflection on the way in which, because the government does not provide certain kinds of services, we expect nonprofits to do it. What you're doing with the catamaran ought to be part of the education system, right? The public educational system.
And
marine education ought to be an integral part of that. But it's not. And so, all of these things are the efforts to provide them in other ways. And, it's so dependent as well on taxes and on tax benefit. No, what's it called? Deductions, tax deductions. That was undermined to some degree by the tax cuts, the Trump tax cuts as well. Again, it's a kind of a question of, over the longer term, what is sustainable in the nonprofit sector? And it's going to be a great shakeout, I suppose.
Yeah, I feel like we're going to see, I hope we see a lot of really creative collaborations. And it's not all been depressing, at least, which is helpful. You know, there have been foundations and funders who have really, instead of turning away or saying, we're going to kind of hold our cards close to our chest and kind of see how this shakes out, see what happens to our money, they're just getting their money out the door. And to me, that is like, it gives me goosebumps. It makes me so happy to know that people recognize how important that is that, our nonprofits need to have that to survive. But I think we're going to see a lot of different unique opportunities and some really huge challenges coming out of this, especially, like I said, being in an environmental nonprofit or being in the arts or being in something that's kind of circling around outside of these, what people see as immediate necessary survival,
Yeah. Well, okay, we're about at the end of the hour, so I want to thank you so much for being my guest Sustainability Now. I really would like to go on a trip, but I haven't been in grades 4 through 6 in a while. I was wondering, do you ever have open houses for the catamaran?
Thanks for asking. So what we do is we have folks who want to come shadow our program. They can just reach out to me, you included. We can schedule a time for you when we're back on for you to come out and just jump on with one of the groups of students. So I'll just share my email. It's just Rachel, R-A-C-H-E-L, at O'NeillCOdyssey.org. So if you're listening and you want to set it up and come out and check out what we do when we get back up and running, and I'd love to have you come out, Ronnie. That would be awesome.
Okay. You can find Rachel's Sentinel column by searching for Santa Cruz Sentinel and Rachel Kippen, and that will turn things up. So two weeks from today, my guest will be Valentin Lopez, chair of the Amamutsun Tribal Band of the Kosanoan Ohlone Indians and president of the Amamutsun Land Trust, and I'm going to ask him to talk about juristic, I think it's called, which is a piece of land over near over the hill, anyway, which is being proposed to turn into some kind of rock quarry. So join me on Sunday, May 3rd from 5 to 6 p.m. right here on KSQD, 90.7 FM on your dial or on KSQD.org. For those of you who can't resist getting up before the sun rises, the station rebroadcasts these Sunday shows every other week on Tuesday mornings from 6 to 7. And I have been trying to get broadcasts from the past up on the KSQD website, but they're also available at tinyurl.com/RESD6JB. And so until next every other Sunday, Sustainability Now.
Oh, Tommy's gone, what shall I do?
Away to Hilo.
My Tommy's gone, and I'll go to
Tommy's gone to Hilo.
Sailing out to Callao.
Away to Hilo.
And Spanish girls he'll meet, I know.
Tommy's gone.
You've been listening to Sustainability Now with Ronnie Lipschitz here at KSQD Santa Cruz.